the response to that kind of introduction is, she can't keep a job. Anyhow, I'm delighted to be here at Cornell. Since I've been asked to give this talk, I have discovered more and more Cornell connections that I didn't know I have. And this is a wonderful place. And what I have been finding out is that it is in part a wonderful place because of Dale Corson. And I'm really honored to be here. Hunter Rawlings gave half my talk. So maybe we can have some discussion. But I do understand that repetition is an acceptable rhetorical device, and so I'm going to use it. And I'm going to be talking about doctoral education in research universities, getting to the people part, where you heard something about the resource part this morning. I did some homework for this meeting. Less than 5 years ago, a symposium was held here in honor of Frank Rhodes, another Cornell leader in American higher education. And the title of the volume that came out of it was The American University, National Treasure or Endangered Species. I see Ron Ehrenberg there blushing. In preparation for this talk, I looked back at that volume and reread what had been written about many of the topics that we were addressing today. And since Hunter repeated the more original part of this talk, given what had been said then, we'll do repetition. In any case, that exercise in hindsight convinced me of the danger of dichotomies, national treasure or endangered species. Turns out, our universities remain national treasures. Yet, as in most dynamic systems, parts remain endangered while other parts thrive. Research universities are resilient institutions. They continue doing what they have always done in the face of enormous changes in the world around them. But change does happen, and they have the flexibility to meet it. I think the cause of endangerment at that time was pressure on the federal funding of university research. We have passed through those shoals, and research funding is again growing, assisted by a federal budget surplus, although, as you saw today, not as a share of the federal budget. That was something that was hard to imagine back then, yet many of the issues raised remain. They're not caused by a dip in research funding. Rather, they are intrinsic to the changes in the American economy and the role that research universities play within it. Here are some of the things, going back to that volume, that the contributors 5 years ago took note of. Harold Shapiro discussed the enduring value of a liberal education for undergraduates. This certainly remains, and you heard about it from President Rawlings. Marianne Fox discussed how much more rapidly the world of work for people with a graduate education is changing than in the past, and how important it is for graduate education to be flexible to respond to that change. We still haven't solved that one, and I will discuss it further today. Bill Bowen discussed diversity, noting the improving educational attainment of blacks, which had not been matched by economic gains, and urged research universities to continue to work to create ways to aid minorities in achieving meaningful equality in American society. I'm not going to talk too much about that question, but as we are well aware, that one hasn't gone away either. Those issues didn't disappear over a five-year period, and a few more have arisen, which I'm going to talk about today. The first is the amazingly rapid spread of information technology. And that's really going to be the core of my discussion. And the other thing is the restructuring of the provision of medical care. I note these two because the transformation of the provision of medical care happened very rapidly and as a result of cost pressures. It illustrates how rapidly seemingly enduring institutions can change. The spread of information technology points to a vehicle that may hasten similar fundamental change in the provision of higher education, both in the U.S. and worldwide. Having noted that the range of new things to say is somewhat limited, I'd like to use this opportunity to try to look ahead a bit. My husband likes to tell a story about vision, and I think I will tell it to you before I present a vision. This is a story about two rabbinical students, one a disciple of the Rabbi of Prague and the other a disciple of the Rabbi of Vienna, who met in an inn one night and were bragging about their respective mentors. The Viennese disciple told stories of his rabbi's erudition. The student of the Rabbi of Prague said, "But my rabbi is gifted with the ability to see amazingly long distances. One day he came to Vienna and was praying when he stopped suddenly and hit his forehead. 'Oh no,' he said, 'my synagogue in Prague, it's burning down.' And he rushed out and returned to Prague immediately." So said the Viennese disciple, "Did it burn down?" "Oh no, it was fine, but what vision." That said, let me present you a vision. What I'm going to do today is first discuss how information technology is changing the way higher education is provided and the effect that that is having on the higher education industry as a whole. You may not often think about it that way, but we are all participating in an industry which maybe as an economist, I think about it more as an industry than perhaps others here do. Second, I want to discuss what that means for what we need to teach our graduate students. And third, I want to end with some issues that vision raises about doctoral education. First, I want to say, and you heard it from Vern Ehlers this morning, that it seems very unlikely that federal funding or even state funding will be the engine of growth for research universities in the future that it was in the past 50 years. Rather, change is much more likely to come in the production process of education. That change in production is likely to be enabled by ubiquitous information technology. Let me start with the evolution of the U.S. higher education system in an information technology-enabled environment. IT, information technology, is just a technology. What really matters is how it is used. And in its use, it seems to me to be a potentially transformative technology, changing the process of research and education, not just the delivery of it. And we will hear more about that later on this afternoon as well. I'm not going to discuss the transformative effect it has had on the disciplines, but let me note four big changes. In biology, without IT, we would be nowhere near as close as we are to sequencing the human genome. In physics, we wouldn't be rethinking everything from the age of the universe to the forces between subatomic particles. In history, we wouldn't be able to construct new theories of the relation between climate and settlement. In classical languages, important texts, formerly limited to special collections, and the glosses on them, would not be available to scholars online and to anyone else with an interest in studying classics. None of this would be possible without the power of networked computing. Of course, This is old news at Cornell, which has pioneered high-volume, high-speed computing. The widest use of information technology, however, is as a medium of communication. Within the university and throughout the community of scholars, it is used for discussion, for collaboration, and for the communication and exchange of data. Research universities are also increasingly involved in the communication of knowledge beyond resident students via distance education, and you heard a little bit about that this morning. Distance education, which I'm going to define as the provision of education to non-residential students, is not new. In some form or other, it's been around for a long time, in print, through extension and correspondence courses, via television, through courses on tape, and later through television, and through two-way television, and now through the internet. It has always been a blessing to the place-bound and to students who wish to combine education and employment. In the research university, distance education has not been a core concern. Recently, alternative providers like Walden University, the Open University, which, by the way, is not just in England, it's here in the United States as well, in cooperation with the University of Florida, I believe, and the University of Phoenix, have been established and are now enrolling thousands of students, actually tens of thousands of students nationwide. These institutions typically provide online instruction combined with face-to-face sessions at places that are convenient to students who are fully employed. Originally aimed at the extension continuing education market, these offerings are now being extended to professional degrees, master's degrees, associate's degrees, and technical certification. These institutions have already received accreditation from the same bodies that accredit ordinary institutions of higher education. It may sound overly competitive to say this, but they are on our turf. Research universities are now entering that market, and you heard a bit about that this morning, either through consortia, r1.edu, I assume, and our more entrepreneurial faculty, and you heard about Arthur Miller this morning, are supplying instruction to online providers, arguing that teaching online falls under university regulations that permit consulting or encourage authorship of instructional materials. The essential economics of distance learning can be described as follows. There are high costs of infrastructure and course production, but low costs of dissemination. In other industries, like telecommunications, this sort of cost structure has led to the emergence of a small number of producers who sell a commodity to large markets at low cost. Research universities have the advantages of brand names that are associated with high quality. But the question arises, how well can they compete with specialist institutions that provide only distance learning with consultants who may even be drawn from the faculty of the research university? These specialist institutions don't have to cover the cost of plant. They don't have to pay to shovel the walkways. They don't have to cover the cost of laboratories or dorms. They can thrive by offering low prices for credit hours and can woo away price-sensitive students. A possible evolution is that low-cost providers may eventually dominate the market, or it may be that specialist institutions will not be the only players. We may see the emergence of hybrid institutions, non-residential universities that provide face time and lab time at widespread learning centers may develop. We already see this with the development of satellite campuses at many public universities. And I'm not just talking about the Cornell Medical Center. That's a satellite campus. But there are other places that combine satellite education at satellite centers with distance ed. The certification that they provide bears the name of the flagship institution. And so you have an Indiana degree or maybe even a Cornell degree. At present, it is unlikely that students with an interest in science or engineering, majors that require hands-on work in laboratories, will be attracted by these providers. As course developers get better, though, at putting together virtual laboratories, or as experiments can be carried out at distant sites, which they can now, that's true of very expensive research equipment at present, science and engineering may no longer be immune. Now, let me ask you to think like a university administrator or economist, painful as that may be. What kind of course are these entrants likely to find, are these schools that are entering, what kinds of courses are they going to find most attractive to offer? The answer is high-volume courses like Economics 1, Introduction to Computer Science, Beginning Accounting, Introduction to English Literature, Introductory Psych, etc. These courses are profit makers for traditional institutions, too. But cyber schools can offer them to more students at a lower price. To the extent that credits are transferable, and that's really not the case now, a lower cost alternative may leave the traditional institutions that do not have a prestige degree to offer with lower enrollments and or high cost courses. So there is cost pressure from market erosion as well as what we've been facing for a while, which is resistance to higher tuition. Research universities are quite lucky in this kind of a scenario. They have endowment, they have research funding, and they have licensing income as alternative sources of revenue. Universities that lack these alternatives may well go out of business. In this vision, the success of a research university will depend critically on an entrepreneurial faculty that focuses on research that is most likely, or appears most likely, to yield a market return. This isn't my vision alone. We're living much of this vision now. The real vision was Clark Kerr's almost 40 years ago, and Max Weber, who didn't show up in my search. Clark Kerr said in his Godkin Lectures, 1963, "The university and segments of industry are becoming more alike. As the university becomes tied into the world of work, the professor, at least in the natural and some of the social sciences, takes on characteristics of an entrepreneur. Industry, with its scientists and technicians, learns an uncomfortable bit about academic freedom and the handling of intellectual personnel. The two worlds are merging physically and psychologically." Does this vision of the future have anything to do with graduate education in research universities? I would argue that it does. The new academia may be largely online, and today's graduate students will be its faculty. The research universities will continue to exist, but they will employ a diminishing share of new PhDs as faculty, and those who are so employed will be chosen in part on the basis of demonstrated entrepreneurial ability. Cornell should do well in this environment, since it has, from the start, combined the useful and the humane arts and sciences. Now let me talk about education of PhDs in the digital university. If you accept this vision of the new higher education, and I get to it, and frankly, I have to say I don't like it, but it's there. We need to educate our graduate students to deal with it. And I think that this education has three elements. The first is flexibility of expectations for graduate students for what they will become. This is not a new point. The COSAPUP report, Reshaping the Graduate Education of Scientists and Engineers, made it, as did Marianne Fox at the Rhodes Symposium. These days, in almost all fields, fewer than half of PhDs end up in academic jobs. All doctoral students need to know what else is out there and have opportunities to experience that kind of work without having to keep it a secret from their advisor. Second thing, teaching and learning in a digital environment. The teachers in my digital scenario do two things. One, they prepare, say, web courses that speak to students who are not in the room with them. This requires attention to a new pedagogy. How are you a model of thinking and learning when people can turn off their computers? Second, the second task is to coach students at learning centers. Yellowing lecture notes won't work. It needs to be efficient, customized instruction. The third element of education has to do with academic work in the new research university. The value is on grantspersonship and license-oriented research. Who is going to pay for the humanistic or the arcane and neglected field? Fields that may actually, without intention, perhaps yield higher returns than the ones where the return can be seen. So, now let me return briefly to the economics of research universities. To an economist, the research university is a nest of cross subsidies. For example, high volume, lower division courses subsidize small, upper division courses. It used to be that surpluses from the medical school subsidized arts and sciences. That may still be the case for other professional schools. Overhead and indirect costs from federal funding of research pay for libraries that may be used by faculty who are not so amply funded, et cetera. Although each of us is certain that somebody else is receiving more than his share of subsidy, university departments and centers do not operate purely as profit centers and probably never will. Doctoral education in arts and sciences, however, has a long tradition of subsidy. In arts and sciences, many doctoral students who finish in a reasonable period of time can expect to be fully funded while they are in graduate school. The growth of cyber competition makes it more difficult to sustain such subsidies. It may be argued that because graduate students provide teaching and research assistance at below market rates, the size of the subsidy of doctoral education is overestimated by tuition plus stipend. You know, we're getting this benefit because we're not paying a regular faculty member to teach that course. However, the traditional justification has been that PhDs are foregoing lucrative, non-academic jobs in order to undertake a long period of research training for academic positions that will be comparatively lowly paid. PhD training stands out as free graduate education compared to costly professional school or master's level training, which is paid for largely by the students themselves. The point of this discussion of cross-subsidy is to suggest that there may be pressure to have students pay a larger share of doctoral education. If that occurs, a number of new pressures emerge. First, the benefits and costs of doctoral education may need to be spelled out more clearly. As in professional schools, tuition may need to be justified by results. This is already the model for master's programs. Enrollments, even in prestigious departments, may become more sensitive to the job market for graduates. The sciences are different. They are reliant on government funding of research, but vulnerable to changes in government funding priorities. As is increasingly the case now, universities' researchers are likely to be driven into the arms of industry, and they may be welcoming arms. This is not necessarily a bad thing, but business operates to make profits, and business partners need to be very patient indeed to encourage curiosity-driven research that may not improve the bottom line in the foreseeable future. Now let us look specifically at what the changing employment market means for graduate education and training. First, where are our doctoral students going? It has been noted in the past 5 years that, in the sciences, an increasing share of new PhDs go to industry and to more training in the form of postdocs. In all fields, for those entering academic employment, there has been a growth in non-tenure track appointments. In the sciences, they are called research faculty, and some are very eminent, and many may be in this room, in fact. But if their research funding goes away, so does their position. That's good for the university, it gives it flexibility, but it's not clear how people feel about a career that is subject to forces, as Congressman Ehlers pointed out, that may be beyond their control. In the humanities, these non-tenure track faculty are called adjunct or part-time faculty. They're positions that may be mutually convenient to following spouses and university employers, but positions that carry no career advancement and increasingly are resulting in a disaffected army of the underemployed. What is appropriate graduate education for this changing employment picture? Let me briefly describe the new competencies. First, education for teaching. In addition to intensive training in research, which we do now, there would be preparation for teaching in an asynchronous learning environment. We need to know more about how pedagogy should change. How can media be combined to make teaching more effective, to keep people from changing sites? How does a professor project to an unseen audience? What are the best ways to provide feedback to students who may send emails at any hour of the day or night? How does a graduate student become an effective coach in a learning center designed to help students learn material developed and presented by others? The Council of Graduate Schools has for a number of years sponsored a program called Preparing Future Faculty, which is explicitly recognized that research university trained PhDs may find themselves teaching in non-research university environments, small colleges, community colleges. This could be extended to include asynchronous instruction. Second, education in research. The principal investigator-based model, where the PI initiated and directed research, is only one model of how research is produced. Not only do teams conduct research in industry, but interdisciplinary research in universities is conducted by teams of investigators in which each researcher brings a special expertise to the research question at hand, but is required to communicate effectively with other investigators who may come from quite different disciplinary backgrounds. In the IT-enabled world, teams can easily be international as well. How do we educate graduate students to carry out this kind of research, especially when many of us have come to it late in life, if at all? Third, education in service. One of the promises of the wired world is availability of learning to audiences who have previously been excluded due to distance from campus, either earlier inadequate education or expense. The land grant model of extension service that links the university to practitioners is worth considering in light of the new technology. K through 12 school teachers, for example, can become more involved in the world of ideas and research at much lower costs than ever before. We need to think of ways of extending arts and sciences scholarship, just as the land-grant universities have always shared agricultural knowledge. Our doctoral students are probably more adept than we are in understanding how best to do that. To encourage that work, however, requires that faculty value that sort of outreach activity. And finally, education in partnership. The research university, as many authors have reminded us, has never been an ivory tower. But management of relationships with patrons, industry, and government needs to be an explicit part of the curriculum for doctoral students who will be negotiating these relationships and may be negotiating them from either side. Non-university partners expect a return on their investment. Universities expect to be allowed free range to do what they do best, investigator-initiated research. Proprietary information may be critical to obtaining profit from the implementation of research, not falling into Ehlers' Valley of Death. Openness and publication are key to scholarly communication and the growth of ideas. Universities themselves may be conflicted as owners of patents. Professors may be principals in startup companies or may possess proprietary information from their membership on boards of scientific advisors. Such issues are part and parcel of the new environment our PhDs will face, and they need to be addressed explicitly in doctoral education. To conclude, we have looked at the pervasive effect of information technology, that it's having on higher education, and in some ways that may or should affect graduate education. A number of the issues raised above have been around for a while, but the maturing of the information age increases their salience. I would argue that research universities need to rethink doctoral education as information technology reshapes higher education. In the past decade, we have seen an increased realization of the varied kinds of employment our doctoral students encounter, and many graduate schools have instituted career colloquia, cooperative programs to prepare future faculty, and growing relationships with industry. On the other hand, many of these actions have been piecemeal, undertaken by some departments but not others. We still hear from graduate students that they can't tell their advisor that they would like to pursue a non-academic job. We see increased unionization efforts among our graduate students, another symptom that students feel the need to readjust what they perceive to be an unfair balance of power. Into this uneasy world comes a transformative technology. Research universities have been happy to embrace it as it transforms research and scholarly communication, but have not really addressed the question of how it will transform their own industry and the workforce that that industry will need. The vision I have presented is really speculation to that end. So, instead of conclusions, I want to leave you with questions. First, given my guesses or your own, is there a need to shape the future, or do we just let it happen? I thought of four issues. There are plenty more. The first, declining enrollments in traditional graduate education. We see that already. Is this an adjustment to an imbalance, or will there be serious shortages? Who will be the next generation of faculty, and how do we get them to be who we want? Second issue, is there a need for increased evaluation of the use of information technology in teaching and research? Everybody's doing it very much on their own. Do we want to take a look at it overall? What criteria would we need to do this? Third issue, will research universities grow further? Who will pay for it if they do? And how will they remain as unique as they are as they do seek to grow? Because that's true of almost all organizations. Fourth, how do we preserve the values of scholarship and inquiry-based research in a world that is increasingly linked to the private sector? It's not bad, it's just there. Second question relates precisely to graduate education for a higher education in a digital environment. Do we need to rethink existing models beyond the change that is already occurring? Three issues. If we recognize explicitly that our doctoral students will conduct research and teaching in a variety of settings, is the PhD required for all of these? People now use the PhD for virtually anything. So what's second issue? What's special about the PhD? Somebody I talked to from an industrial employer said, we like to hire PhDs because they've shown they can finish something. Anyhow, a PhD provides a certification of conduct of independent and original research. Are there alternatives, less expensive ways of demonstrating the ability to conceive and complete a piece of research? Third issue, what would an alternative model look like? The possibility would be master's degrees combined with continuing education, where going back and forth to the university into training is a much more frequent occurrence. You don't just leave and then you get a letter from the development office. You come back and learn things. And actually, I know from my friends that Cornell does some of this, and the alums I know who do it like it a lot. Anyhow, how could such an alternative for training teaching faculty become more respected? And I think it could. I know we're short of time, and so we won't have questions now, but I really look forward to your discussion tomorrow and continued speculation on these issues. Thank you.